to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, April 7th, 2024. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a playwright, journalist, and historian with a number of books. His new book, Brain Teasers for Broadway Geniuses, is now available wherever finer books are sold. Peter also has columns at Masterworks Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Hello, Peter.
Hi.
Hello. Coming up in just 3 days from now, we have at Theater 555, and the winner is you. So, Peter, tell us about this evening.
Yes, indeed. This is certainly an award show where, indeed, people in the audience are the winners. They've signed up in advance. We don't pull anybody out who doesn't want to be pulled out. But the rest of the audience can certainly enjoy seeing these people give their acceptance speeches, which they've had prepared forever, which was for us has not had our acceptance speech ready for to be aired across the world at a fine swank ceremony. So, you have to sign up in advance, and I'm all cast. As a result, the rest of the people can just sit in the audience and watch. That's all that they have to do. So don't fear anything in terms of audience participation, but I would love to see you there at Theater 555 on Wednesday, April 10th, 7 p.m. In the show notes, you'll see my email to RSVP, and I hope to see you there.
All right. So that is just coming up 3 days away. So check it out if you're in the New York area. That'd be great. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael's a theater reviewer and essayist. He's the founder and editor of castalbumreviews.com. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You could see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
Michael, I meant to ask you, with all these shows opening up in April and March and things like that, does castalbumreviews.com have a lot of extra work that comes down the pipe all at once?
Well, yes. And also, we're still dealing with a backlog of recordings that have come out since the pandemic. Mm-hmm. But for example, Charles Kirsch, my hero, just recently submitted a review of the Gardens of Annunzia cast album, which we posted. So we do have some things that are very, very up to date, and we're just trying to fill in as quickly as we can in terms of reviews of new recordings.
So you have lots of listening, pondering, and writing to do for all these things. This is
yes. Yeah, well, I'm glad that I'd, you know, if it was just me, I'd probably be dead. But there, I've got, well, theoretically about 20 people helping me. I mean, not constantly, but our stable of writers is about 20, maybe more. So that's a huge help.
Well, that's great. And you can get over there to castalbumreviews.com. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. So in the Broadway radio feed, Jan Simpson's All the Drama, the Strange Interlude by Eugene O'Neill, a 1928 Pulitzer Prize winner, was released on Patreon this week. So that's patreon.com/Broadway Radio. And next week to the general public, if you want to take a listen to it. But quite an interesting description of Strange Interlude. I've never seen it. Peter, Michael, have you seen Strange Interlude? And have you seen the long version?
Yeah, in England in 1984, Glenda Jackson did a production that did come over here. I didn't see it here,
That's right.
I did see it there. Also, of course, David Greenspan memorized the whole thing.
Yeah.
And did it out in Brooklyn, which was really something as well. So, yeah, it's quite a play. And I will say this, I remember so well at the end of 2 hours in England, that was the first intermission. And I thought, whoa, I mean, usually here we're out of the theater at this point and we've barely just started. And yet I am so engrossed. I am so engrossed that I really feel like I've been here 10 minutes. The other thing, this was such a famous play that there's actually a Marx Brothers movie. I forget which one, that parodies it. So it was that big a deal at the time that even in a movie which was going across the country, people were expected to know what Strange Interlude was.
Yeah.
Jan got into the details of O'Neill, and I didn't realize how lucrative it was to be a playwright back in those days. You know, it seems that O'Neill really did very well for himself with his plays. I mean, four-time Pulitzer Prize winner, I'd imagine that that it doesn't get.
Be, right?
Yeah, exactly. All right. So this week we got some sad news that Christopher Durang passed away on Tuesday night at the age of 75. Peter, do you have any remembrances of Mr. Durang?
Yeah, I met him when he was a sophomore at Harvard. He was doing a show called The Greatest Musical Ever Sung, which was a parody of biblical movies. And it was set to existing show songs. We took the melodies. I don't know if he ever got in trouble about this, but for example, at the Last Supper, he put new lyrics to This Was a Real Nice Clam Bake. When Jesus came in on Palm Sunday, everybody sang to the tune of Mame, who took the sins right out of the whore, Jesus, who took the pus right out of the sore, Jesus. So even then, as a sophomore, he was showing a lot of wit and a lot of feelings about the Catholic Church. We talked about it that quite a bit. I mean, needless to say, this was a small production at Harvard. It was by no means at one of their major theaters. They have house shows there, which are done in various buildings. And that's where it was, in a small little building. I don't think there were 20 people in the house, but I certainly was there and demanded to meet him afterwards to say how terrific it was. And so he knew every time he saw me that I was going to bring this up. And he was certainly good-natured about it. But it was pretty apparent then that this was a guy with tremendous imagination, and he certainly made good on it. It's really something to think that one of his first works, if not his first work, in History of the American Film, actually got a big Broadway production at what is now the August Wilson Theater. Didn't last long. But it was an expensive show to run, and it certainly was, as so much of his work was, and he'd be the first one to tell you that, hit or miss. there were times when you'd sit in a theater and his jokes would fall flat, and other times the performers would have to wait a great deal of time until everybody stopped laughing. So he's certainly fondly remembered, and I'm sorry to say that I did know for a long time that he was seriously ill, so this did not come as a surprise.
Michael, any remembrances?
Yes, I was privileged to interview Mr. Durang when he was about to, when his show Adrift in Macau was about to open at Primary Stages. And this was a musical that he wrote with Peter Melnick. Does that name strike a bell, Peter?
Yes, indeed.
Would you care to identify Peter Melnick?
This is the other Adam Gettle, right?
Yes.
There is a relationship to Richard Rodgers because one of his daughters married a Melnick.
And it was a really wonderful interview. I one of the most interesting interviews I ever did because Chris, whatever I should call him, he had such a great sharp mind, and he was so witty. And I remember when we were talking in the interview, I got a reference that he threw out, and that seemed to make him happy that I knew what he meant. So many, so many wonderful plays. I think I have just found my interview from 2007. So I will try to send that link along. But he really was so talented. He had a number of notable flops, including Sex and Longing on Broadway with Sigourney Weaver. And I mean, I personally do think that one sort of deserved to flop. I just didn't think it worked on any level, but his brilliant stuff, Sister Mary Ignatius, explains it all for you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All his little parodies, his parody of the glass menagerie is beyond hilarious. And of course, I'm so glad when he had, I guess, a late career success with Vanya and Sonia and Masha mm-hmm, and Spike, mm-hmm. which did extremely well on Broadway and then also all over. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone mm-hmm. was doing that play mm-hmm, mm-hmm. At one time. And lately, I've read of more recent productions. And now we have one that's coming up, which was announced before his death, right? With a reunion of some of the cast members, including David Hyde Pierce and Sigourney Weaver. So if you can get to see that. But also I want to put in a special word for Beyond Therapy, which that was a flop on Broadway, but I thought that was completely undeserved as a flop. I thought it was beyond hilarious. Beyond Therapy was beyond hilarious. And it had Diane Wiest. It had John Lithgow. It was hysterically funny. And it also had, in a tiny role, David Pierce, as he was then called.
That's right. Yeah.
In a tiny role. But this is, it also seems to me that Chris Durang was very loyal. And if he liked you, he would, use you again and again in his plays. So I always admired that in an artist. He really was really, really, really was terrific. And the success of Vanya and Sonia just made me so, so happy. Because it looked for a while like maybe he was not going to have another really big success like that. And it turned out to be his biggest success in terms of, mainstream, Broadway success. So I'm just thinking there's no film of that, is there?
No. There is a film of Sister Mary Ignatius.
Yes.
Diane Keaton made. I think it was done for Showtime on one of those networks. And again, one of my favorite lines is when she is telling all the people that Catholics should avoid, because they'll go to hell, because these people are going to hell. And, she mentions Roman Polanski, and that's fine, I guess. But but then she mentions Betty Cobden and Adolph Green. I mean, really, come on. What have Betty and Adolph done? I mean, that's so bad, So you don't go to hell for a doll's life. No, I really, it was sad. Well, but what kind of mind thinks those two in conjunction with hell?
Well, that was exactly his kind of humor.
Absolutely.
Just to throw in something like Betty Comden and Adolph Green in a list like that. And it's so silly that you just have to laugh.
That's right.
No, he really was brilliant.
It was also interesting to see that play and watch the audience, because you could tell who the Catholics were, or at least the Catholics who had been Catholics. It was very easy to tell. So again, he certainly alienated some audience members. And when I posted this little remembrance of the greatest musical ever sung, a couple of people said that they railed against the way he handled Catholicism. And, it's not easy. People have faith, and they certainly are entitled to what they believe, so, and all that goes with that. But anyway, for many people, it was just plain funny.
Yes.
All right. So the New York Times did a number of pieces on Chris Durang. I have them linked in the show notes if you want to check them out. Truly just beloved across the entire community. Just what a wonderful life. So in our review section, Peter, you got over to the Sea Dog Theater to see Tuesdays with Maury with our friend Len Cario. So tell us about this.
Well, this is a very demanding play because, after all, it's only two characters, and Len Cario certainly has a lot to do and say. And, he's no kid anymore, and as a result, one would think this would be too daunting a challenge for a person who's well into his 80s. He rises to the occasion, and I won't be surprised if one of the reasons he rises to the occasion has something to do with Chris Domig, D-O-M-I-G. Who is his scene partner here, and it's a two-person show, And Mr. Domig is terrific beyond belief as well. So what's the story? Mitch Albom had a college professor that he was very fond of, but time takes its toll, life takes its toll, and he was lost touch with him, and that was that, as so many of us do with our beloved teachers. I wonder what happened to Dr. Kenny. But then suddenly on Nightline, he sees a spot on this guy, and he's very surprised to see him. But as it turns out, Maury, the professor, is seriously ill. And as a result, he gets in touch with him. Now, he's doing very well, our Chris Domig character, Mitch Albom. He's doing very well. He's got a wonderful job and certainly has obviously money to spend, because he agrees to visit Maury every Tuesday. Now, that's quite a commitment, and we're led to believe that he didn't miss any. It's quite a commitment, not only financially, but after all, you have to tell your boss that you're not going to be there on Tuesdays. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an amazing thing. But apparently, this is what happened, and this is we watch a man decline. And we watch a man try to say all the right things, which is so hard to do when you know somebody is dying. But it's very, very impressive how Mitch Albom certainly, at least for this play, came up with the right words at the right time. I won't say I'm necessarily convinced that at the moment that it was happening that he came up with these right things at the right time. But still, if it's something that he looks back on and says, I wish I had said that, maybe that should have come up in the play. But anyway, this was a show that was going to run for a few weeks in March. Now it's been extended, and I'm not surprised why. Let me say a couple of things about the venue. It is in a church. You're not sitting in pews. You are sitting in chairs. But the thing is, and this is so true of so many churches that I've been in, including St. Clement's in the 40s, the sound often is echoey, because these places were not meant to be theaters. And so if you go, you are going to get that echo feeling right away, and you're going to say, uh-oh, this is going to be really bad, because it's not a short show, and there's no intermission. But, you know, it's so funny. Our ears really adapt. After a while, it just doesn't seem to be a problem. So don't get discouraged if after the first few minutes you're saying, oh, this is going to be so painful. No, it really, it's, I mean, I find this true even when people who are on stage and speak softly and are criticized heavily for it. After a while, you just adjust, and somehow you hear. Our ears really step up to the challenge, and it does here too. So a very, very worthwhile evening. Needless to say, a laugh fest, but as in any good show that deals with tragedy, there's certainly a laugh to be heard here and there. So, we know that Len Carey is going to be good, but to find out that Chris Domig can be so good too is a nice revelation.
All right. So that is Tuesdays with Maury at the Sea Dog Theater, which is on 16th Street, East 16th Street. It is running through April 20th, so you have about 2 weeks left to go check it out. Last week, Peter talked about the Who's Tommy, the revival that's happening at the Nederlander. And this week just passed, Michael and I got a chance to see it actually on the same evening. So, Michael, why don't you get us started on the Who's Tommy?
Well, I have a history with this show, as I'm sure I've mentioned before, because I directed a production of Tommy on Staten Island in the early 80s, about 10 years or so before it came to Broadway the first time. And what we did was, at that time, there was no script. There was no stage adaptation. So we just licensed the music, as if you hear it on the concept album. And we worked from that. And then I wrote a scenario around it. And it was fully, fully staged with a very, very large cast. And as far as the scenario, I I really, a lot of the ideas were my own. The couple of things we took from the movie, but only a couple because that movie's kind of zany. That Ken Russell movie is very wild and not really according in line with my sensibility of how this may should be presented.
Yes. May I interrupt here to say that if somebody who had no knowledge of Broadway radio tuned in right now and heard this description of Ken Russell, he would not know which of Ken Russell's movies you were talking about. Because that's true of each and every one of them. They're wild and crazy. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go on.
No, that's fair. Although I guess I would say The Boyfriend is odd in a different way than some of
it
the others.
It is, yes. But it's very odd.
Yes, yes. Anyway, so among other things, Tommy has changed greatly significantly in terms of the content from the concept album through the movie, through the original Broadway production, and now this one. Some pretty major changes in the scenario, also the order of the songs, for example, in this production is very different. Many of the songs, the order is very different than you'll find on the concept album and even in the movie. I'm sure I mentioned before, when it came time to do the initial Broadway production, for whatever reason, Pete Townsend, who wrote most of this opera, this rock opera, decided to change the whole point of the ending. Because to make a long story short, in the original production, the original concept, Tommy is a young boy who is suddenly struck deaf, dumb, and blind, as they phrase it, when he sees his I have to keep reminding myself, when he sees his mother, his father had gone off to war and was missing in action and presumed dead. This is, actually, in the original, it's supposed to be World War I, I think, because... They think the father is dead, and so the mother takes up with another man. Then, unexpectedly, the father returns without being announced that he's coming back, which, of course, doesn't make any sense, but we'll leave that for the moment. And then in the original, what happens is that Tommy's father kills the lover of the mother, and Tommy witnesses that murder, and then he is struck deaf, dumb, and blind. Now, in the movie, one of the few good changes that I thought were made in the scenario is that it was changed that the lover kills the father, and I thought that was a good change because it seems to me it's even more traumatic, obviously, for a boy to have his father killed in front of his eyes than some random guy. I mean, they're both traumatic, but you see my point. So I thought that was a good idea, and when we did our production, we kept it that way, that the lover kills the father. Anyway, Tommy goes on to doing all these things to try to cure him. The father or the lover, whoever survives, brings him to a woman called the Acid Queen to sort of initiate him to drugs and sex. They leave him with babysitters who are extremely bad choices. His uncle Ernie and his cousin Kevin, both of whom abuse Tommy in one way or another. Anyway, eventually it somehow happens that he realizes that he's really good at playing pinball, even though he's can't see, can't hear, and can't speak. So he becomes a sensation as a pinball player. And then eventually he is cured when his mother throws him into a mirror in frustration, and the shock of that restores his sight and his hearing and his speech. And then he becomes a sort of a messiah, you know, like this person who has already a celebrity, and now he's been cured of miraculously cured of these afflictions. And so he becomes almost like a Christ figure, a Messiah who everyone starts following. And then in the original version, Tommy starts to abuse his position, and everyone turns against him and actually attacks him and beats him up and leaves him alone to start over again. But anyway, it's already a really long story that I'm trying to make short. In the rewrite, Pete Townsend has Tommy say the opposite and say, you know, there's nothing special about me. You're all special in your own way. And I just thought that was a far weaker ending for the original Broadway production that has been retained for this one. I wish that hadn't happened to begin with. I guess it's just... a change in Pete Townsend's worldview, but I mean that didn't mean he had to rewrite the show. I mean it's not exactly his story, although apparently it is somewhat based on his own life. The original production was very, very elaborate in terms of special effects and lighting and really spectacular things happening on stage with a very large cast and very, very loud. All of that has been retained here, except maybe increased in every way, especially the projections, I think, and the lighting and the special effects. The songs, as I said, are in different order than the original. Sensation is now in the first act, which used to be in the second act, and that was where Tommy first started to act like a messiah, and we could see why people would turn against him. And the original lyric was, "I leave a trail of rooted people mesmerized by just the sight. The few I touched now are disciples. Love is one. I am the light." All of those lyrics are not in it anymore. So that is the kind of thing that I thought really worked well in the original and has been cut here. The cast is very strong. I would say Ali Luis Bursky as the adult Tommy, and Alison Luff as his mother, and Adam Jacobs as his father. Then we also have John Ambrosino, Bobby Conte, Christina Sagos. It wasn't as loud as I feared it would be. I had been warned about how loud the show was, and I even brought earplugs in preparation. But I didn't need them. It was far from the loudest show I have ever heard on Broadway. So, I mean, that's all very subjective, and your mileage may vary. But for what it's worth, I didn't feel I needed my earplugs. Lots and lots and lots of choreography by Lauren Lataro. But I guess that's the final point I'd like to make here. And actually, a friend of mine said something similar. There is so much in this show in terms of projections and special effects and never-ending choreography that it becomes more than a little relentless. I think if there had been some more moments with only a few people on stage and maybe some less frenetic moments, that then when the stops were all pulled out, those moments would have been much more effective. For example, Pinball Wizard here seems like just another number, you know, whereas in the movie, for example, and in our production when we did it, it was this huge climax that we built to the end of the first act in our case. So that, I think, is one of the big flaws of this whole conception of Tommy. I love the music so much that I very much enjoyed it in spite of everything. And that young leading man, Ali Luis Bursky, he has an exceptional voice. So I think that fans of Tommy will like this if you don't mind the changes, which are significant. And if you don't know the previous Broadway version, you'd be prepared that there are a lot of rethinking here, and you may or may not like it.
It's interesting what you say about the loudness, because that was something that I remember as though it was yesterday from the St. James with the original production, how loud it was. It was just the loudest thing I'd ever been to in my life, I think, at that point. And I was really worried about going to the Niederlander this week, and I forgot my earplugs, and it was fine. Yeah. It was it was not as loud as I thought it was going to be. And
same here. Yeah. So
it was really wonderful to revisit this music. And see this. I think.
Or are we just getting too old? Our hearing is deteriorating.
Well, could be. And also getting used to it.
Yeah.
Over the years.
Yes.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. We've had 30 years of ear pods and AirPods and various things in our ears, walking around with phones and MP3 players in our pockets for the last 30 years, which wasn't really the case.
Oh, right. But I also meant just in terms of the Broadway shows, the three loudest ones I can remember, not necessarily in order, were Starlight Express, Be More Chill, and Dance of the Vampires.
Be More Chill was crazy loud for me. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the Janis Joplin show that I can't remember the name of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that seemed to be extraordinarily loud for me. But back in the Tommy world, Alison Luff, who played Mrs. Walker, and Adam Jacobs, who played Captain Walker, I thought that they were wonderful, outstanding, and I hope that they are recognized in the award season coming up. A great, great cast all around, very strong. I wish it hadn't been, you know, sort of a remounting of the original, which is it's not just a Tommy thing, but I feel like whenever I go see an Evita or a Sweeney or, you know, some other thing that gets revived a bunch of times, I wish I hadn't seen it in that same type of concept. I wish that it had been rethought and different.
Right.
Who played? I went to look this up before we started to talk. Who played Uncle Ernie in the original production? I can't remember who it was, but this John Ambrosino that plays Uncle Ernie here, I thought did a great acting job.
I think that I'm glad you brought that up, because I think they really have reconceived the character and tried to make him obviously very, very remorseful for what he does to Tommy. I think they portray him as just somebody who's really damaged. And in the beginning, he's very nice and very helpful in bringing rations you know, to the mother, and and then and we see that he's an alcoholic, and I think that's a whole reflection of you know, Pete Townsend has said that he was sexually abused as a youngster by, I believe, his grandmother. So there's not a direct parallel here, but it's a subject that is very close to him in that sense, and I think they I wouldn't be surprised if he was instrumental in having this character portrayed that way, you know, rather than as a monster, just as a very, very sick person.
And Bobby Conte as Cousin Kevin was just really just oily, sleazy, awesome.
Yes.
He was great. And Christina Sajous as the Acid Queen. It seems as though that they are moving away from that imprint of Tina Turner to be sort of its own character. And Christina Sajous was great. Just amazing.
Her voice, I thought, was phenomenal. Phenomenal.
So that is Tommy playing over the Niederlander, and in open run right now. Hopefully, if you're a fan of this musical, you can get over and see this production, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Peter, you headed over to Playwrights Horizons to see Teeth. So tell us about Teeth.
Well, there are times that teeth are going to make your teeth very visible because you'll be smiling. But on the other hand, there are going to be times when you're going to be gritting your teeth. So it's a wild and crazy show, as you've probably heard. And that's not going to be any surprise to anybody who's been paying attention to, well, for that matter, Michael R. Jackson's entire career, when you think about it, because A Strange Loop had a lot of strange sexual situations, and we have a very strange sexual situation here. But, you know, again, here's a guy who, credit where it's due, and I mean a lot of credit is due. This is his third musical that we've seen, and the thing is that not one of them resembles the other in any way. And that's very helpful and very exciting to see that he likes to go into very, very different territories to get what he needs to get. And this is based on a film. Have you heard of this film? I had not. Teeth, did either of you hear of this film?
No, I just saw that it was adapted. I didn't realize that it was an adaption. Mitchell,
well, apparently it was a very, very much a cult film, not exactly a, you know, a Dune or a or so, a Star
so
Wars.
If Radio, yeah. So if Radio City was still showing movies, it wouldn't have been the, the summer attraction. Okay. Well, anyway, supposedly this is something that is based on strange legends that some women have teeth in their vaginas. So this turns out to be a problem for the young man that our heroine, Don O'Keefe, is dating because, well, in the 60s, we used to say use it or lose it. But here's a case where he used it and he lost it because her teeth took over. Yes, that's a very unpleasant image, but it happens more than once in this show. Great credit to Michael R. Jackson for adhering to craft. Perfect rhymes abound, which I'm very happy to say. And very, very smart images as well. So as a lyricist, really top-notch work. Whoa, I mean, I don't know how much Anna K. Jacobs, who wrote the book, took from this movie. But for me, it went all over the place. I really thought the end of the show would come when indeed a young man who has been established as gay. Oh, by the way, we're dealing with a high school-y type of situation, as so many musicals do. But anyway, he says to her in essence that, perhaps if they made love, it wouldn't happen anymore, that her teeth would disappear, because it wasn't the same type of sex that, she had been having with the other guys. And I really thought that was the end of the show, meaning that love would conquer all, that he really did love her in his own way. And that this would do it. No, that's not what happens at all. And it goes on for quite some time after that. So, frankly, it was like trying to catch a butterfly. I couldn't catch what the ultimate meaning of this show was. There was certainly a feminist agenda in it, and I'll understand that being brought into the mix, certainly. But I don't know what the point is of saying that if true love can't conquer teeth in a vagina. I don't know what can. I'm at a loss, really. As always, with Playwrights Horizons, a first-class production, and we have to be grateful that it has that. Stephen Pasquale is in it, too. He plays a very holy roller type of pastor who sees sin in everything. And certainly Sarah Benson has done as good a job as anybody could do with this script and this concept. But adventurous, that's the best way I can put it.
Okay. So that is Teeth at Playwrights Horizons. It's been extended through April 28th, and it's a hard-to-get ticket. So if you have the stamina and the teeth, go see Teeth.
Audience, okay. Adored it. Adored it.
All right. So Michael and Peter were over at New World Stages and saw a production of Stalker. So Michael, why don't you get us started on Stalker?
Well, it stars, it has a two-person cast. These two fellows from Sweden called Brynolf and Ljung. That's Brynolf and Ljung. Presented by Penn and Teller. And the title of the show is Stalker. And the fact that Penn and Teller are presenting might give you a vague idea of what kind of a show it is. It's basically what, I mean, the easiest way to describe it, I guess, is a mind reading show. These two perform various, well, would you call them tricks? I mean, they're supposedly not tricks, that by which they can guess what card an audience member has picked or what kind of image they're thinking of, or all of these very clever, elaborate mind reading demonstrations. One thing that makes this show very different in that respect is that they also have more than one section in the show where they have the audience members participate as the mind readers. And I've never seen that before. One would think that that would make it more difficult to fake the mind reading if that is indeed what's going on. And many people would guess that is what's going on. So that really impressed me. But also, whenever I see a show like this, or Ricky Jay, any show that seems to be magic or mind reading like that, I always have very mixed feelings because I'm fascinated and amazed by it, but also kind of frustrated because I cannot figure out how the hell they did it. you know, assuming that it's not actual mind reading, which many people would assume it's not. So that was my reaction. These two guys, though, they're extremely engaging. Of course, you would have to be in this kind of a show because it's, despite all the audience participation, it's really just the two of them for the whole length of the show. This is not the first such show I've seen at New World Stages. They seem to be having a little niche of these kinds of, magic mind reading little shows, in addition to other kinds of shows too. Very, very entertaining. I don't think you will be bored. I think you will be very much entertained and amazed and perhaps a little frustrated like me, because you can't figure out how the hell they do it.
Peter, how about you? What was your experience?
Well, my feeling is always with shows like this, there's obviously a way to do it. I'm never frustrated by them because they figure something out. It's within the human capability of doing it. But here's what was interesting to me. At the end of the show, they had asked, they bring a guy up who earlier in the show, they had asked to pick from one of seven cards on the stage. And at the end of the show, they explained why he would pick the first card. And it made a lot of sense. What came to mind was something Rupert Holmes told me about the mystery of Edward Drood, and that is the fact that at the end of the show, when people were asked to pick the murderer, the people tended to pick the first one. And so as a result, the person picking the first one got to have this big confessional song while the rest of the people just stood there, and he had written songs for everybody. And so what he decided to do was have the person who played the first person on Monday be the last person on Tuesday, the first person on Tuesday be the last person on Monday, et cetera. So it would be a rotating rep so that everybody would get a chance. He said, because people have a tendency to pick the first thing. In a restaurant, when people ask for the specials, they tend to pick the first special that is mentioned. And they actually bring this up. that indeed the reason, one of the reasons the guy picked the card he picked, the first card, has a lot to do with the fact that people tend to pick the first one. But also, you know, now that I think this should have been a spoiler alert, there are other subtle reasons which they disclose why he would pick up that card. And right. That was of more than moderate interest to me. So, and through the entire show, I'm wondering, why is this called Stalker? And they do give a good reason why at the end. But Stalker, which has a terrible, terrible connotation, and nobody likes the word, and nobody wants to be involved with the word. It's meant in a very benign way here. Very benign, and nobody has anything to fear.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. I do think that maybe the title was not the best one, because it certainly led me to expect something else, a much darker show.
Sure.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't we?
All right. So Stalker is playing at the New World Stages through September 1st. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. Michael, you got over to Lincoln Center Theater to see Corruption. So tell us what you thought about this production.
This is a really fascinating new play by J.T. Rogers, who also wrote Oslo. If you like that one, I think you'll like this one. It's, I guess, basically in the very same style of a dramatization of a really, really compelling and fascinating real life situation. In this case, it was the whole hacking scandal that took place in London and England, surrounding Rupert Murdoch and his empire. I was surprised here. I hadn't done a lot of research about this show before going in to see it, and I had heard Rupert Murdoch mentioned. And so I was quite surprised when I got to the theater and I opened the playbill to see that Rupert Murdoch is not one of the characters. However, his son, James, is a character. That is played by Seth Numerick, by the way. So that intrigued me to begin with. I'm sure, I mean, obviously it was a very strategic decision not to include Rupert Murdoch as an actual character on stage. I wonder what exactly went into that decision. It would be interesting to ask J.T. Rogers at some point. Because Rupert Murdoch is still supposed to be alive, you know, at the time of the, and is he still alive?
Yeah.
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 Just
okay,
got married. Or, yeah, just again, like wife number eight or something like that.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. So maybe they were afraid of a lawsuit. I don't know. But there are all these other real life characters portrayed here. And I have to immediately give kudos to Toby Stevens in the central role of Tom Watson, who's the fellow who tries to bring down, kind of the whole empire, but specifically this woman, Rebecca Brooks, played by Saffron Burroughs, who is in power at one of these horrible, despicable British tabloids. And all of these revelations start coming out about the very evil and awful things that these publications will do in pursuit of a story. So it's fascinating to anyone, and especially maybe those of us who have whose lives have had something to do with journalism. Really, really great idea and very well executed, very well directed by Bartlett Sher. I was somewhat put off by the extreme amount of doubling and tripling among the cast members. Let's see, we've got 13 cast members playing a much larger much larger number of characters. I understand that it would not have been financially feasible to have all of those characters played by different people. But in some cases, it was a little confusing, especially when someone came on in one scene and then in the next scene is someone else. And we were supposed to realize that they were someone else just because they were suddenly wearing glasses or maybe a different wig. But that's my only major criticism here. I thought it was a very crackling play, to use that old adjective. It moves at a very, very swift pace, and you're always paying attention to try to take everything in and follow all of the twists and turns of the real life plot. But also excellent casting here for the show, which is not in the Beaumont Theater. It's in the New House. So it's an considered off-Broadway equivalent. But you've got Dylan Baker, John Bellman, the aforementioned Saffron Burroughs, Anthony Cochrane, Sanjay De Silva, K. Todd Freeman, Eleanor Handley, Robin Kerr, Sepide Moafi, the aforementioned Seth Numrick, Michael Sibbery, I always love seeing him on stage, T. Ryder Smith, and Toby Stevens as Tom Watson, who, in case our listeners don't know, Toby Stevens is the son of Maggie Smith, and he certainly got the genes, let me tell you, in terms of acting ability. So I really highly recommend Corruption. It's on every level, I think it's really worthwhile and very, very compelling.
All right. So Corruption at Lincoln Center is playing through April 14th. So you have about 7 days left to check it out. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. Peter, you headed over to the Belasco where you saw Appropriate. Last time that you had seen it was in December at the Hayes. So you went back to visit it again. Tell us what you thought of it.
Well, it's still terrific, though. I will say the ending is a little bizarre to me. But up until then, it really is sensational, especially because Sarah Paulson is so amazing as the relative from the ninth circle of hell. Boy, I hope she wins the Tony. Well, who knows? I mean, who knows what I'm going to be seeing in the next few weeks, but I would bet everything I have that she'll at least get a nomination. But terrific performance. Well, here's the thing. What I want to mention is that at the performance I attended, the intermission was terribly long. And finally, an announcement was made that the actress playing Cassidy, the very young girl in the play, would not continue with the show, and somebody else would take over the part, I assume, her understudy, I assume. But the thing was, these two kids didn't look anything alike. Now, I don't mean in terms of their faces. That's not what I mean. I mean that the second Cassidy was at least a foot taller and seemed much older. And frankly, at the risk of bringing up anything that might cause the younger girl to lose her job, it worked better because one of the points of the play is that this girl has a real crush on her older cousin, and who is certainly much too old for her and much too sophisticated for her, even though he's not sophisticated, but in comparison, he is. So it seemed much more threatening and realistic, and that she would be interested in him. And it brought a new level to the play because at this point we wondered if indeed he would consort with her. Well, it was never something that would have occurred to us when the girl was so much younger and so much shorter, for that matter, in the first act. So, funny, we're always talking about at awards time about a category called unique theatrical experience, which usually means shows off the beaten path that aren't necessarily word heavy. But this was a unique theatrical experience. I'm not sure it's ever happened to me before that somebody's taken over midstream. So as a result, it made it much more interesting to me, not just for the dynamics of somebody coming in at obviously short notice, but also because I thought it improved the actual production.
Okay. So that is appropriate. The Belasco playing through June 23rd, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes.
You know, Peter, that's been known to happen at the opera.
Oh, yeah?
Over the years, yeah, yeah. And I remember hearing it happening on Broadway, but I just cannot think of a specific example.
Yeah, I'm
moment.
Not remotely saying it's unprecedented, but I believe it's the first time it's happened to me.
Yeah.
So, Michael, you were on the Upper West Side on 86 in Amsterdam, where you have the center at West Park, and you saw a production of Spring Awakening. So tell us about it.
Yeah, well, first of all, the venue, it's West Park Presbyterian Church, which is really very historic, if y'all don't know it. It's at the corner of 86th and Amsterdam, and the started as a Presbyterian church built in 1890, and it has quite a history. Reading here, among other notable activities in the 20th century, West Park was the first home of Joseph Papp's Shakespeare Festival, the birthplace of God's Love We Deliver and the West Side Food Pantry, the first church in New York City to support gay marriage. So it's really quite historic. The auditorium, it does have pews, but the sight lines are quite good, better than some theaters I've been in recently, including the Lucille Lortel Theater, which we'll save that for another day. But yeah, so I went primarily because, well, I love Spring Awakening, but also I know I'm acquainted with someone in the cast here, and he mentioned it to me. He asked me to attend. There was some question about whether I would actually review it because it's a very young company that's just starting out, and it's not, you know, they're not completely professional, There was some trepidation about that, but let me read about the company to you. Breaking Borders International Performing Artists Inc. Is a 501c3 nonprofit company founded by Janine Molinari, Denny Lanza, and Max Bartos, with the aim of extending the arms of artistic collaboration beyond linguistic and geocultural borders. Breaking Borders is committed to creating high-quality new and reimagined works in multiple disciplines, including theater, music, dance, and visual arts. They have a relationship. This is a New York/Italian collaboration here. The people they're working with are primarily and almost all from Italy. And this show is a mixture of people, the leads and the ensemble, people from Italy, performers from Italy, and Americans. So, for example, we have as Melchior, we have Rocco di Donato from Florence. We have as Wendla Francesca Montecchi, also from Florence. But as Moritz, we have this fellow named Max Bartos, who is an Equity member. He's got the little asterisk. And he was in Sing Street, for anyone who saw that. And boy, he really was great as Moritz. I mean, I've seen some amazing Moritzes in Spring Awakening in both the musical and the original play. I've seen several productions of both, but he was among the very best. Everyone was wonderful in all of the roles. Very, very professional. It seems that director and the choreographer, the director is Denny Lanza, choreographer Giovanni Cenicola, music director Sean Palatroni. I have to tell you, I think that the direction and choreography here were at least equal, if not better, to what I saw on Broadway. So these young people, they are in really, really good hands. It was the professionalism level of the whole thing was amazing to me. I think they said they had between 7 and 10 days of rehearsal, but the choreography, unlike what someone mentioned earlier, in terms of Tommy, was so sharp. I was almost amazed because I did not expect it to be so thoroughly 100% professional, and a very large cast of extremely talented people, including the fellow I know a bit, Joe Tolentino, as Georg. They even had some double casting. Double casting in the terms of people going on for different performances. But I only saw, you know, the one cast. And I do have to mention, among the entire group of very, very talented and very professional performers, there was Ava Delaney in the role of Ilsa. And when she came out, I thought, wow, she is Broadway ready. And so I wasn't surprised when I looked in the program and saw that little equity asterisk next to her name. So I think it's great that they mix American performers with Italians, that they mix equity with non-equity. Everyone can learn from each other. The less experienced people can learn from those who have more experience. I think that's one of the best things about theater. And so I really am glad I attended this production. There's so much going on now, theater-wise, on and off Broadway, and I was thinking about skipping it because I'm literally out every single night, I think, it seems like, for the next month and a half. But I do love Spring Awakening, and I did have this friend in it, so I thought I should go, and I'm very, very, very glad that I did.
Okay. So that's Spring Awakening at the Center at West Park. We'll have a link to that in the show notes for more information. And finally, this morning, Peter, you were over at Ellen Stardust Diner to see an event where they are partnering for the month of April with an organization called Love Michael. So tell us about it.
Well, yes, indeed. This is Lisa Liberatore started a company for her autistic son, Michael, who has become a pretty good chef, actually, as time has gone on. And speaking of matters culinary, they decided to partner with Ellen Stardust Diner, which has to be one of the most popular places in town. I have never passed by without seeing a line that extends all the way down to 7th Avenue. It's amazing to me. If you haven't been in, this was my first time, frankly. It's a 50s retros diner. They have a nice display of original cast album covers on one wall. I'm a little disappointed that Chorus Line and My Fair Lady are a bit obscure by a sign about the restroom, but nevertheless, they're there. So they decide to partner with Ellen Hartstrom, who, by the way, easily admits to being Miss Subway's 1959, and certainly doesn't look as if she would have been anywhere on the planet in 1959. But anyway, this is a restaurant where indeed the waiters get up and sing, and boy, talent agents, Michael Cassara, Tara Rubin, get over there. I'm telling you, the people who performed are terrific beyond belief. But anyway, what has happened is that Love Michael, that's L-U-V, by the way, Love Michael, which makes granola, decided to partner with Ellen's Diner with their milkshakes. And so you get these wonderful granola-topped milkshakes in vanilla and chocolate, and 20% of the proceeds go to help Love Michael. So it's a very good cause, and certainly if you're inclined to stand in that line, which you're going to have to do, it is that popular, then indeed you will find a wonderful milkshake with wonderful granola on top waiting for you.
Okay. So we'll have a link to Ellen's Stardust Diner and Love, Michael on the show notes. And just quickly, we have a couple of news items that we'll say a word or two about. Kate Schindel stepping down as Actors Equity president. Peter, Michael, any thoughts?
She's a terrific lady. She was once Miss America. And I'm telling you, she her diplomacy, I've seen her in action, is really, really terrific. This is a loss, but one can understand why having that job would certainly wear on you. And I think she did it 9 years. And I may be wrong. Is it 9 years? Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a long time to be doing this job, which is thankless in many ways. And I don't believe it's a paid position.
It's unpaid. Unpaid 9 years. Yes.
Yeah, really.
So... Michael, anything?
Well, I will say it's certainly been an extraordinarily turbulent time during her tenure, the pandemic alone. But it seems like more and more very thorny issues keep arising with equity. And many people I know are unhappy about some of the way that they've handled some things. I can't imagine why anyone would actually want that job, especially if it's unpaid. So you have to hand it to her in that respect. I think just to accept that responsibility for no remuneration whatsoever. She said specifically that she's leaving because she would like to pursue her acting career again. She said, she's been so busy as the president of Equity that she's acted so infrequently that she hasn't even acted enough to earn enough points to qualify for insurance, for health insurance through, because that's how they, that's how Equity works. You, you need to work a certain number of weeks per year or season or whatever in order to keep your health insurance. So that's one of the biggest issues that they've always had through probably Equity's entire existence. So I hope she finds some nice roles to play. And I'm sure she's going to enjoy the relief from the tremendous responsibility.
Sure.
And let's end our morning on a really big high note here. Joe Iconis and Lauren Marcus welcome their first child. Michael, what's the lowdown?
Well, I don't know lots of details, but it's a daughter and her name is Roxy.
It's the name on everybody's lips.
It's going to be.
Joe, only 735 days till the terrible twos.
Well, our best goes out to them. So before we head out to this morning and get to our brain teasers and our musical moments, I want to remind everybody that you could subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayVideo.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to Apple Podcasts for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us on Apple Podcasts. There's many ways to get us. One way is Patreon, patreon.com/Broadway Radio is a way to get our broadcasts early, plus support all of the Broadway Radio shows that are out there, and listen to Jan Simpson and Jenna Tessa Fox had something a couple of weeks ago, and all those other things. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, and me can be found in the show notes at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So, Peter, do we have an answer to last week's brain teaser?
What do these Broadway musicals have in common? Wish You Were Here in the 50s, Coco in the 60s, Dude in the 70s, Joan Robins Broadway in the 80s, Passion in the 90s, and Avenue Q this century. Well, they all played previews and didn't go out of town. That's what I was looking for. And the reason, of course, Wish You Were Here did not go out of town had a lot to do with the fact that it had a swimming pool. So they really had to put that in the Imperial and leave it at that. So this was a tough question for a lot of people. A lot of answers that weren't at all near correct. But Josh Israel was the first to get it, followed by Brigadude and Tony Janicki, after he made 525,600 guesses. But that was it for everyone. All right, this week's question. The Show Me State, the Bluegrass State, and the Land of Lincoln could very well bring to mind a musical theater character. How?
Okay, if you have an answer for this, email us at trivia@broadwayvideo.com. We'll let you know if you're on the right track. So, Michael, what do we have in this week's musical moments?
Well, our opener and our closer, we have music from the original recording of Tommy by The Who. The opening is the overture, appropriately, and the closer is the underture, which we discussed last week. I asked Peter if there was an underture in the current production, and he hadn't noticed it. I went through the song list. There is nothing listed as the underture in the current Broadway production, but the music that is identified as the underture on the original recording is very much in this production, heard in, I think, in snippets in various different places. And actually, I think it's one of the most beautiful sections of the score by Pete Townsend. So please enjoy the overture and the underture from Tommy by The Who.
All right. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.